How did you find him?
From what I hear, it was pure luck. A helicopter off a frigate was patrolling and spotted him in the water. They didn't have any rescue gear aboard, so they marked the spot with a dye marker and went back to their ship. A bosun volunteered to go in after him. They loaded him and a raft canister into the chopper and flew him back, with the frigate hustling down south. The bosun kicked out the raft, jumped in after it, and landed on it. Bad luck. He broke both his legs. But he did get your sailor into the raft. The tin can picked them up an hour later, and they were both flown directly here.
How is your man?
He'll be all right. The left leg wasn't too bad, but the right tibia was badly splintered. Jameson went on. He'll recover in a few months. Won't be doing much dancing for a while, though. The Russians thought the Americans had deliberately removed their man's identification. Jameson and Tate suspected that the man had disposed of his tags, possibly hoping to defect. There was a red mark on the neck that indicated forcible removal.
If it is permitted, Smirnov said, I would like to see your man, to thank him.
Permission granted, Captain, Tate nodded. That would be kind of you.
He must be a brave man.
A sailor doing his job. Your people would do the same thing. Tate wondered if this were true. We have our differences, gentlemen, but the sea doesn't care about that. The sea, well, she tries to kill us all, regardless what flag we fly.
Petchkin was back, looking through the window, trying to make out the patient's face.
Could we see his clothing and personal effects? He asked.
Sure, but it won't tell you much. He's a cook. That's all we know, Jameson said.
A cook?
Petchkin turned around. The officer who listened in on the tape, obviously he was an intelligence officer, right? He looked at the number on his shirt and said it made him a cook. The three-digit number indicated that the patient had been a member of the port watch and that his battle station was damage control. Jameson wondered why the Russians numbered all their enlisted men. To be sure they didn't trespass? Petchkin's head, he noticed, was almost touching the glass pane.
Dr. Ivanov, do you wish to attend the case? Tate asked. Is this permitted?
It is.
When will he be released?
Petchkin inquired.
When may we speak with him?
Released? Jameson snapped. Sir, the only way he'll be out of here in less than a month will be in a box. So far as consciousness is concerned, that's anyone's guess. That's one very sick kid you have in there.
But we must speak to him, the KGB agent protested.
Tate had to look up at the man. Mr. Petchkin, I understand your desire to communicate with your man, but he is my patient now. We will do nothing, repeat nothing, that might interfere with his treatment and recovery. I got orders to fly down here to handle this. They tell me those orders came from the White House. Fine. Doctors Jameson and Ivanov will assist me, but that patient is now my responsibility, and my job is to see to it that he walks out of this hospital alive and well. Everything else is secondary to that objective. You will be extended every courtesy, but I make the rules here.
Tate paused. Diplomacy was not something he was good at.
Tell you what, you want to sit in there yourselves in relays? That's fine with me, but you have to follow the rules. That means you scrub, change into sterile clothing, and follow the instructions of the duty nurse. Fair enough?
Petchkin nodded. American doctors think they are gods, he said to himself.
Jameson, busy re-examining the blood analyzer printout, had ignored the sermon.
Can you gentlemen tell us what kind of sub he was on?
No,
Petchkin said at once.
What are you thinking, Jamie?
The dropping white count and some of those other indicators are consistent with radiation exposure. The gross symptoms would have been masked by the overlying hypothermia.
Suddenly, Jameson looked at the Soviets.
Gentlemen, we have to know this. Was he on a nuclear sub?
Yes, Smirnov answered. He was on a nuclear-powered submarine.
Jamie, take his clothing to radiology. Have them check the buttons, zipper, anything metal for evidence of contamination.
Right.
Jameson went to collect the patient's effects.
May we be involved in this? Smirnov asked.
Yes, sir, Tate responded, wondering what sort of people these were. The guy had to come off a nuclear submarine, didn't he? Why hadn't they told him at once? Didn't they want him to recover?
Petchkin pondered the significance of this.
Didn't they know he had come off a nuclear-powered sub? Of course, he was trying to get Smirnov to blurt out that the man was off a missile submarine.
they were trying to cloud the issue with this story about contamination. Nothing that would harm the patient, but something to confuse their class enemies. Clever. He'd always thought the Americans were clever. And he was supposed to report to the embassy in an hour. Report what? How was he supposed to know who the sailor was?
Norfolk Naval Shipyard. The USS Ethan Allen was about at the end of her string. Commissioned in 1961, she had served her crews and her country for over 20 years, carrying Polaris sea-launched ballistic missiles in endless patrols through sunless seas. Now she was old enough to vote, and this was very old for a submarine. Her missile tubes had been filled with ballast and sealed months before. She had only a token maintenance crew while the Pentagon bureaucrats debated her future. There had been talk of a complicated cruise missile system to make her into an SSGN like the new Russian Oscars. This was judged too expensive. Ethan Allen's was generation-old technology. Her S-5W reactor was too dated for much more use. Nuclear radiation had bombarded the metal vessel and its internal fittings with many billions of neutrons. Recent examination of test strips had revealed that over a period of time the character of the metal had changed, becoming dangerously brittle. The system had, at most, another 3 years of useful life. A new reactor would be too expensive. The Ethan Allen was doomed by her senescence. The maintenance crew was made up of members of her last operational team, mainly old-timers looking forward to retirement, with a leavening of kids who needed education and repair skills. The Ethan Allen could still serve as a school, especially a repair school, since so much of her equipment was worn out. Admiral Gallery had come aboard early that morning. The chiefs had regarded that as particularly ominous. He had been her first skipper many years before, and admirals always seemed to visit their early commands, right before they were scrapped. He'd recognized some of the senior chiefs and asked them if the old girl had any life in her. To a man, the chief said yes. A ship becomes more than a machine to her crew. Each of 100 ships built by the same men at the same yard to the same plans will have her own special characteristics, most of them bad, really, but after her crew becomes accustomed to them, they are spoken of affectionately, particularly in retrospect. The admiral had toured the entire length of the Ethan Allen's hull, pausing to run his gnarled, arthritic hands over the periscope he had used to make certain that there really was a world outside the steel hull, to plan the rare attack against a ship hunting his sub, or a passing tanker, just for practice. He'd commanded the Ethan Allen for 3 years, alternating his gold crew with another officer's blue crew, working out of Holy Loch, Scotland. Those were good years, he told himself, a damn sight better than sitting at a desk with a lot of vapid aides running around. It was the old Navy game, up or out. Just when you got something that you were really good at, something you really liked, it was gone. It made good organizational sense. You had to make room for the youngsters coming up. But God, to be young again, to command one of the new ones that now he had only the opportunity to ride a few hours at a time. A courtesy to the skinny old bastard in Norfolk. She'd do it, Gallery knew. She'd do fine. It was not the end he would have preferred for his fighting ship, but when you came down to it, a decent end for a fighting ship was something rare. Nelson's victory, the Constitution in Boston Harbor, the odd battleship kept mummified by her namesake state. They had honorable treatment. Most warships were sunk as targets or broken up for razor blades. The Ethan Allen would die for a purpose, a crazy purpose, perhaps crazy enough to work, he said to himself as he returned to ComSubland headquarters. 2 hours later, a truck arrived at the dock where the Ethan Allen lay dormant. The chief quartermaster on deck at the time noted that the truck came from Oceana Naval Air Station. Curious, he thought. More curiously, the officer who got out was wearing neither dolphins nor wings. He saluted the quarterdeck first, then the chief who had the deck while Ethan Allen's remaining two officers supervised a repair job on the engine spaces. The officer from the Naval Air Station made arrangements for a work gang to load the sub with 4 bullet-shaped objects, which went through the deck hatches. They were large, barely able to fit through the torpedo and capsule loading hatches, and it took some handling to get them emplaced.
Next came plastic pallets to set them on, and metal straps to secure them.
They look like bombs, the chief electrician thought as the younger man did the donkey work. But they couldn't be that. They were too light, obviously made of ordinary sheet metal.
An hour later, a truck with a pressurized tank on its load bed arrived. The submarine was cleared of her personnel and carefully ventilated. Then three men snaked a hose to each of the four objects. Finished, they ventilated the hull again, leaving gas detectors near each object.
By this time, the crew noted, their dock and the one next to it were being guarded by armed Marines so that no one could come over and see what was happening to the Ethan Allen.
When the loading or filling or whatever was finished, a chief went below to examine the metal shells more carefully. He wrote down the stenciled acronym PPB-76A/J6713 on a pad. A chief yeoman looked the designation up in a catalog and did not like what he found. Pave Pat Blue 76. Pave Pat Blue 76 was a bomb, and the Ethan Allen had four of them aboard. Nothing nearly so powerful as the missile warheads she had once carried, but a lot more ominous, the crew agreed. The smoking lamp was out by mutual accord before anyone made an order of it. Gallery came back soon thereafter and spoke with all the senior men individually. The youngsters were sent ashore with their personal gear and an admonition that they had not seen, felt, heard, or otherwise noticed anything unusual on the Ethan Allen. She was going to be scuttled at sea. That was all. Some political decision in Washington. And if you tell that to anyone, start thinking about a 20-year tour at McMurdo Sound, as one man put it. It was a tribute to Vincent Gallery that each of the old chiefs stayed aboard. Partly it was a chance for one last cruise on the old girl, a chance to say goodbye to a friend. Mostly it was because Gallery said it was important, and the old-timers remembered that his word had been good once. The officers showed up at sundown. The lowest ranking among them was a lieutenant commander. Two four-striped captains would be working the reactor, along with three senior chiefs. Two more four-stripers would handle the navigation, a pair of commanders, the electronics. The rest would be spread around to handle the plethora of specialized tasks necessary to the operation of a complex warship. The total complement, not even a quarter the size of a normal crew, might have caused some adverse comment on the part of the senior chiefs, who didn't consider just how much experience these officers had. One officer would be working the diving planes, the chief quartermaster was scandalized to learn. The chief electrician he discussed this with took it in his stride. After all, he noted, the real fun was driving the boats, and officers only got to do that at New London. After that, all they got to do was walk around and look important. True, the quartermaster agreed. But could they handle it? If not, the electrician decided, they would take care of things. What else were chiefs for but to protect officers from their mistakes? After that, they argued good-naturedly over who would be chief of the boat. Both men had nearly identical experience and time and rate. The USS Ethan Allen sailed for the last time at 23:45 hours. No tug helped her away from the dock. The skipper eased her deftly away from the dock with gentle engine commands and strains on his lines that his quartermaster could only admire. He served with the skipper before, on the Skipjack and the Will Rogers. "No tugs, no nothing," he reported to his bunkmate later. "The old man knows his shit." In an hour, they were past the Virginia Capes and ready to dive. 10 minutes later, they were gone from sight. Below, on a course of 110. The small crew of officers and chiefs settled into the demanding routine of running their old boomer shorthanded. The Ethan Allen responded like a champ, steaming at 12 knots, her old machinery hardly making any noise at all.
The 11th day. Monday, 13th December. An A-10 Thunderbolt. It was a lot more fun than flying DC-9s. Major Andy Richardson had over 10,000 hours in those, and only 600 or so in his A-10 Thunderbolt II strike fighter, but he much preferred the smaller of the twin-engine aircraft. Richardson belonged to the 175th Tactical Fighter Group of the Maryland Air National Guard. Ordinarily, his squadron flew out of a small military airfield east of Baltimore,
But 2 days earlier, when his outfit had been activated, the 175th and six other National Guard and Reserve Air Groups had crowded the already active SAC base at Loring Air Force Base in Maine. They had taken off at midnight and had refueled in midair only half an hour earlier, 1,000 miles out over the North Atlantic. Now Richardson and his flight of four were skimming 100 feet above the black waters at 400 knots. 100 miles behind the four fighters, 90 aircraft were following at 30,000 feet in what would look very much to the Soviets like an alpha strike, a weighted attack mission of armed tactical fighters. It was exactly that, and also a feint. The real mission belonged to the low-level team of four. Richardson loved the A-10. She was called with backhanded affection the Warthog, or just plain Hog, by the men who flew her. Nearly all tactical aircraft had pleasing lines conferred on them by the need in combat for speed and maneuverability. Not the Hog, which was perhaps the ugliest bird ever built for the U.S. Air Force. Her twin turbofan engines hung like afterthoughts at the twin rudder tail, itself a throwback to the 30s. Her slab-like wings had not a whit of sweepback and were bent in the middle to accommodate the clumsy landing gear. The underside of the wings were studded with many hard points so ordnance could be carried, and the fuselage was built around the aircraft's primary weapon, the GAU-8 30mm rotary cannon designed specifically to smash Soviet tanks. For tonight's mission, Richardson's flight had a full load of depleted uranium slugs for their Avenger cannons and a pair of Rockeye cluster bomb canisters, additional anti-tank weapons. Directly beneath the fuselage was a Lantern, low-altitude navigation and targeting infrared for night, POD. All the other ordnance systems, save one, were occupied by fuel tanks. The 175th had been the first National Air Guard squadron to receive Lantern. It was a small collection of electronic and optical systems that enabled the Hog to see at night while flying at minimum altitude, searching for targets. The systems provided a heads-up display, HUD, on the fighter's windshield, in effect turning night to day and making this mission profile marginally less hazardous. Besides each Lantern pod was a smaller object which, unlike the cannon shells and Rockeyes, was intended for use tonight. Richardson didn't mind. Indeed, he relished the hazards of the mission. Two of his three comrades were, like him, airline pilots, the third a crop duster, all experienced men with plenty of practice in low-level tactics, and their mission was a good one. The briefing, conducted by a naval officer, had taken over an hour. They were paying a visit to the Soviet Navy. Richardson had read in the papers that the Russians were up to something, and when he had heard at the briefing that they were sending their fleet to trail its coat this close to the American coast, he had been shocked at their boldness. It had angered him to learn that one of their crummy little day fighters had backshot a Navy Tomcat the day before, nearly killing one of its officers. He wondered why the Navy was being cut out of the response. Most of the Saratoga's air group was visible on the concrete pads at Loring, sitting along the B-52s, A-6E intruders, and F-18 Hornets, with their ordnance carts a few feet away. He guessed that his mission was only the first act, the delicate part. While Soviet eyes were locked on the Alpha Strike hovering at the edge of their SAM range, his flight of four would dash in under radar cover to the fleet flagship, the nuclear-powered battleship Kirov, to deliver a message. It was surprising that guardsmen had been selected for this mission. Nearly 1,000 tactical aircraft were now mobilized on the East Coast, about a third of them reservists of one kind or another, and Richardson guessed that that was part of the message. A very difficult tactical operation was being run by second-line airmen, while the regular squadrons sat ready on the runways of Loring and McGuire and Dover and Pease and several other bases from Virginia to Maine, fueled, briefed, and ready. Nearly 1,000 aircraft. Richardson smiled. There wouldn't be enough targets to go around.
Linebacker lead, this is Sentry Delta. Target bearing 048, range 50 miles. Course is 185, speed 20.
Richardson did not acknowledge the transmission over the encrypted radio link. The flight was under MCON. Any electronic noise might alert the Soviets. Even his targeting radar was switched off, and only passive infrared and low-light television sensors were operating. He looked quickly left and right. Second-line flyers? Hell, he said to himself. Every man in the flight had at least 4,000 hours, more than most regular pilots would ever have, more than most of the astronauts and their birds were maintained by people who tinkered with aeroplanes because they liked to. The fact of the matter was that his squadron had better aircraft availability rates than any regular squadron and had fewer accidents than the wet-nosed hot dogs who flew the warthogs in England and Korea. They'd show the Ruskies that. He smiled to himself. This sure beat flying the DC-9 from Washington to Providence and Hartford and back every day for U.S. Air. Richardson, who had been an Air Force fighter pilot, had left the service 8 years earlier because he craved the higher pay and flashy lifestyle of a commercial airline pilot. He missed Vietnam, and commercial flying did not require anything like this degree of skill. It lacked the rush of skimming at treetop level. So far as he knew, the Hog had never been used for maritime strike missions. Another part of the message. It was no surprise that she'd be good at it. Her anti-tank munitions would be effective against ships. Her cannon slugs and rock-eye clusters were designed to shred armored battle tanks, and he had no doubts what they would do to thin-hulled warships. Too bad this wasn't for real. It was about time somebody taught Ivan a lesson. A radar sensor light blinked on his threat receiver. S-band radar. It was probably meant for surface search, and was not powerful enough for a return yet. The Soviets did not have any aerial radar platforms, and their ship carrier sets were limited by the Earth's curvature. The beam was just over his head. He was getting the fuzzy edge of it. They would have avoided detection better still by flying at 50 feet instead of 100, but orders were not to. "Linebacker flight, this is Sentry Delta. Scatter and head in," the AWACS commanded. The A-10s separated from their interval of only a few feet to an extended attack formation that left miles between the aircraft. The orders were for them to scatter at 30 miles distance, about 4 minutes. Richardson checked his digital clock. The linebacker flight was right on time. Behind them, the Phantoms and the Corsairs in the Alpha Strike would be turning towards the Soviets just to get their attention. He ought to be seeing them soon. The HUD showed small bumps on the projected horizon, the outer screen of destroyers. The Odaloys and Sovremenys. The briefing officer had shown them silhouettes and photos of the warships. Beep! The threat receiver chirped. An X-band missile guidance radar had just swept over his aircraft and lost it, and was now trying to regain contact. Richardson flipped on his ECM, electronic countermeasures, jamming systems. The destroyers were only 5 miles away now. 40 seconds. Stay dumb, comrades, he thought. He began to maneuver his aircraft radically, jinking up, down, left, right, in no particular pattern. It was only a game, but there was no sense in giving Ivan an easy time. If this had been for real, his Hogs would be blazing in behind a swarm of anti-radar missiles, and would be accompanied by wild weasel aircraft trying to scramble and kill Soviet missile control systems. Things were moving very fast now. A screening destroyer loomed in his path, and he nudged his rudder to pass clear of her by a quarter mile. 2 miles to the Kirov. 18 seconds. The HUD system painted an intensified image. The Kirov's pyramidal, mass-stacked radar structure was filling his windshield. He could see blinking signal lights all around the battlecruiser. Richardson gave more right rudder. They were supposed to pass within 300 yards of the ship, no more, no less. His Hog would blaze past the bow, the others past the stern and either beam. He didn't want to cut it too close. The major checked to be certain that his bomb and cannon controls were locked in the safe position. No sense getting carried away. About now, in a real attack, he'd trigger his cannon, and a stream of solid slugs would lance the light armor of the Kirov's forward missile magazines, exploding the SAM and cruise missiles in a huge fireball, and slicing through the superstructure as if it were thin as newsprint. At 500 yards, the captain reached down to arm the flare pod, attached next to the lantern. Now! He flipped the switch, which deployed half a dozen high-intensity magnesium parachute flares. All 4 linebacker aircraft acted within seconds. Suddenly, the Kirov was inside a box of blue-white magnesium light. Richardson pulled back on his stick, banking into a climbing turn past the battlecruiser. The brilliant light dazzled him. but he could see the graceful lines of the Soviet warship as she was turning hard on the choppy seas, her men running along the deck like ants.
If we were serious, you'd all be dead now. Get the message? Richardson thumbed his radio switch.
Linebacker lead to Sentry Delta, he said in the clear. Robin Hood, repeat Robin Hood. Linebacker flight, this is lead. Form up on me. Let's go home.
Linebacker flight, this is Sentry Delta. Outstanding, the controller responded. Be advised that Kiev has a pair of forgers in the air, 30 miles east, heading your way. They'll have to hustle to catch up. We'll advise. Out.
Richardson did some fast arithmetic in his head. They probably could not catch up, and even if they did, 12 Phantoms from the 107th Fighter Interceptor Group were ready for it.
Hot damn, lead! Linebacker 4, the crop duster, moved gingerly into his slot. Did you see those turkeys pointing up at us? God damn, did we rattle their cage!
Heads up for forgers, Richardson cautioned, grinning ear to ear inside his oxygen mask.
Second-line flyers, hell!
Let 'em come, Lineback 4 replied. Any of those bastards closes me and my 30, it'll be the last mistake he ever makes.
4 was a little too aggressive for Richardson's liking, but the man did know how to drive his hog.
Linebacker flight, this is Sentry Delta. The forgers have turned back. You're in the clear. Out.
Roger that. Out. Okay, flight, let's settle down and head home. I guess we've earned our pay for this month.
Richardson looked to make sure he was on an open frequency.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Captain Barry Friendly, he said, using the in-house U.S. Air public relations joke that had become a tradition in the 175th. I hope you've enjoyed your flight, and thank you for flying Warthog Air.
The Kirov. On the Kirov, Admiral Stralbo raced from the Combat Information Center to the flag bridge, too late. They had acquired the low-level raiders only a minute from the outer screen. The box of flares was already behind the battlecruiser, several still burning in the water. The bridge crew, he saw, was rattled.
60 to 70 seconds before they were on us, Comrade Admiral, the flag captain reported. We were tracking the orbiting attack force, and these four, we think four, raced in under our radar coverage. We had missile lock on two of them, despite their jamming.
Stralbo frowned. That performance was not nearly good enough. If the strike had been real, the Kirov would have been badly damaged at least. The Americans would gladly trade a pair of fighters for a nuclear-powered cruiser. If all American aircraft attacked like this...
The arrogance of the Americans is fantastic, the fleet Zampali swore.
It was foolish to provoke them, Stralbo observed sourly. I knew that something like this would happen, but I expected it from Kennedy.
That was a mistake, a pilot error, the political officer replied.
Indeed, Vasily. And this was no mistake. They just sent us a message, telling us that we are 1,500 kilometers from their shore without useful air cover, and that they have over 500 fighters waiting to pounce on us from the west. In the meantime, Kennedy is stalking us to the east like a rabid wolf. We are not in an attractive position.
The Americans would not be so brash.
Are you sure of that, Comrade Political Officer?
Sure.
What if one of their aircraft commits a pilot error and sinks one of our destroyers? And what if the American President gets on a direct link to Moscow to apologize before we can even report it? They swear it was an accident and promise to punish the stupid pilot. Then what? You think the Imperialists are so predictable this close to their own coastline? I do not. I think they are praying for the smallest excuse to pounce on us. Come to my cabin. We must consider this.
The two men went aft. Stralbo's cabin was a Spartan affair. The only decoration on the wall was a print of Lenin speaking to Red Guards.
What is our mission, Vasily?
Stralbo asked.
To support our submarines. Help them to conduct the search.
Exactly. Our mission is to support, not to conduct offensive operations. The Americans do not want us here. Objectively, I can understand this. With all our missiles, we are a threat to them.
But our orders are not to threaten them, the Zampali protested.
Why would we want to strike their homeland?
And of course, the Imperialists recognize that we are peaceful socialists. Come now, Vasily. These are our enemies. Of course they do not trust us. Of course they wish to attack us, given the smallest excuse. They are already interfering with our search, pretending to help. They do not want us here. And in allowing ourselves to be provoked by their aggressive actions, we fall into their trap.
The Admiral stared down at his desk.
Well, we shall change that. I will order the fleet to discontinue anything that may appear the least bit aggressive. We will end all air operations beyond normal local patrolling. We will not harass their nearby fleet units. We will use only normal navigational radars.
And?
And we will swallow our pride and be as meek as mice. Whatever provocation they make, we will not react to it.
Some will call this cowardice, Comrade Admiral, the Zampalit warned.
Strabo had expected that.
Vasily, don't you see? In pretending to attack us, they have already victimized us. They force us to activate our newest and most secret defense systems so they can gather intelligence on our radars and fire control systems. They examine the performance of our fighters and helicopters, the maneuverability of our ships, and most of all, our command and control. We shall put an end to that. Our primary mission is too important. If they continue to provoke us, we will act as though our mission is indeed peaceful, which it is as far as they are concerned, and protest our innocence. And we make them the aggressors. If they continue to provoke us, we shall watch to see what their tactics are and give them nothing in return. Or would you prefer that they prevent us from carrying out our mission?
The Zampalit mumbled his consent. If they failed in their mission, the charge of cowardice would be a small matter indeed. If they found the renegade submarine, they'd be heroes regardless of what else happened. The Dallas.
How long had he been on duty? Jones wondered. He could have checked easily enough by punching the button on his digital watch, but the sonar man didn't want to. It would be too depressing.
Me and my big mouth. You bet, Skipper. My ass, he swore to himself. He detected the sub at a range of about 20 miles, maybe. Had just barely gotten her, and the fucking Atlantic Ocean was 3,000 miles across, at least 60-footprint diameters. He'd need more than luck now.
Well, he did get a Hollywood shower out of it. Ordinarily, a shower on a freshwater poor ship meant a few seconds of wetting down and a minute or so of lathering, followed by a few more seconds of rinsing the suds off. It got you clean, but was not very satisfying. This was an improvement over the old days, the old-timers like to say. But back then, Jones often responded, the sailors had to pull oars or run off diesel and batteries, which amounted to the same thing. A Hollywood shower is something a sailor starts thinking about after a few days at sea. You leave the water running, a long, continuous stream of wonderfully warm water. Commander Mancuso was given to awarding this sensuous pastime in return for above-average performance. It gave people something tangible to work for. You couldn't spend extra money on a sub, and there was no beer or women. Old movies? They were making an effort on that score. The boat's library wasn't bad, when you had time to sort through the jumble, and the Dallas had a pair of Apple computers and a few dozen game programs for amusement. Jones was the boat champion at Choplifter and Zork. The computers were also used for training purposes, of course, for practice exams and programmed learning texts that ate up most of the use time. The Dallas was quartering an area east of the Grand Banks. Any boat transiting Route 1 tended to come through here. They were moving at 5 knots, trailing out the BQR-15 towed array sonar. They'd had all kinds of contacts. First, half the submarines in the Russian Navy had whipped by at high speed, mainly trailed by American boats. An Alpha had burned past them at over 40 knots, not 3,000 yards away. It would have been so easy, Jones had thought at the time. The Alpha had been making so much noise that one could have heard it with a glass against the hull, and he'd had to turn the amplifiers down to minimum to keep the noise from ruining his ears. A pity they couldn't have fired. The setup had been so simple, the firing solution so easy that a kid with an old-fashioned slide rule could have done it. That Alpha had been meat on the table. The Victors came running next, and the Charlies and Novembers last of all. Jones had been listening to surface ships away to the west, a lot of them doing 20 knots or so, making all kinds of noise as they pounded through the waves. They were far off,
and not his concern. They had been trying to acquire this particular target for over 2 days, and Jones had had only an odd hour of sleep here and there. Well, that's what they pay me for, he reflected bleakly. This was not unprecedented. He'd done it before, but he'd be happy when the labor ended. The large aperture towed array was at the end of a 1,000-foot cable. Jones referred to the use of it as trolling for whales. In addition to being their most sensitive sonar rig, it protected the Dallas against intruders shadowing her. Ordinarily, a submarine's sonar will work in any direction except aft, an area called the Cone of Silence, or the Baffles. The BQR-15 changed that. Jones had heard all sorts of things on it, subs and surface ships all the time, low-flying aircraft on occasion. Once, during an exercise off Florida, it had been the noise of diving pelicans that he could not figure out until the skipper had raised the periscope for a look. Then, off Bermuda, they had encountered mating humpbacks, and a very impressive noise that was. Jones had a personal copy of the tape of them for use on the beach. Some women found it interesting, in a kinky sort of way. He smiled to himself. There was a considerable amount of surface noise. The signal processors filtered most of it out, and every few minutes Jones switched them off his channel, getting the sound unimpeded to make sure they weren't filtering out too much. Machines were dumb. Jones wondered if SAPS might be letting some of that anomalous signal get lost inside the computer chips. That was a problem with computers, really a problem with programming. You'd tell the machine to do something, and it would go and do it to the wrong thing. Jones often amused himself working up programs. He knew a few people from college who drew up game programs for personal computers. One of them was making good money with Sierra Online Systems. Daydreaming again, Jonesy, he chided himself. It wasn't easy listening to nothing for hours on end. It would have been a good idea, he thought, to let sonar men read on duty. He had better sense than to suggest it. Mr. Thompson might go along, but the skipper and all the senior officers were ex-reactor types with the usual rule of iron. You shall watch every instrument with absolute concentration all the time. Jones didn't think this was very smart. It was different with sonar men. They burned out too easily. To combat this, Jones had his music tapes and his games. He could lose himself in any sort of diversion, especially Choplifter. A man had to have something, he reasoned, to lose his mind in, at least once a day. And something on duty, in some cases. Even truck drivers, hardly the most intellectual of people, had radios and tape players to keep them from becoming mesmerized. But sailors on a nuclear sub costing the best part of $1 billion? Jones leaned forward, pressing the headphones tight against his head. He tore a page of doodles from his scratch pad and noted the time on a fresh sheet. Next, he made some adjustments on his gain controls, already near the top of the scale, and flipped off the processors again. The cacophony of surface noise nearly took his head off. Jones tolerated this for a minute, working the manual muting controls to filter out the worst of the high-frequency noise. Aha! Jones said to himself. Maybe SAPS is messing me up a little. Too soon to tell for sure. When Jones had first been checked out on his gear in sonar school, he'd had a burning desire to show it to his brother, who had had a master's in electrical engineering and worked as a consultant in the recording industry. He had 11 patents to his name. The stuff on the Dallas would have knocked his eyes out. The Navy's systems for digitalizing sound were years ahead of any commercial technique. Too bad it was all classified, right alongside nuclear stuff. Mr. Thompson, Jones said quietly, not looking around, can you ask the skipper if maybe we can swing more easterly and drop down a knot or two? Skipper, Thompson went out into the passageway to relay the request. New course and engine orders were given in 15 seconds. Mancuso was in sonar 10 seconds after that. The skipper had been sweating this. It had been obvious 2 days ago that their erstwhile contact had not acted as expected, had not run the route, or had never slowed down. Commander Mancuso had guessed wrong on something. Had he also guessed wrong on their visitor's course? And what did it mean if their friend had not run the route? Jones had figured that one out long before. It made her a boomer. Boomer skippers never go fast. Jones was sitting as usual, hunched over his table, his left hand up commanding quiet as the towed array came around to a precise east-west azimuth at the end of its cable. his cigarette burned away unnoticed in the ashtray. A reel-to-reel tape recorder was operating continuously in the sonar room. Its tapes changed hourly and kept for later analysis on shore. Next to it was another whose recordings were used aboard the Dallas for re-examination of contacts. He reached up and switched it on, then turned to see his captain looking down at him. Joan's face broke into a thin, tired smile. "Yeah," he whispered. Mancuso pointed to the speaker. Joan shook his head. "Too faint, Captain. I just barely got it now. Roughly north, I think. But I need some time on that." Mancuso looked at the intensity needle Jones was tapping. It was down to zero. Almost. Every 50 seconds or so, it twitched. Just a little. Jones was making furious notes. "The goddamn SAPS filters are blanking part of this out. We need smoother amplifiers and better manual filter controls," he wrote. Mancuso told himself that this was faintly ridiculous. He was watching Jones as he had watched his wife when she'd had Dominic, and he was timing the twitches on a needle as if he had timed his wife's contractions. But there was no thrill to match this. The comparison he used to explain it to his father was the thrill you get the first day of hunting season, when you hear the leaves rustle, and you know it's not a man making the noise. But it was better than that. He was hunting men. Men like himself, in a vessel like his own. "Getting louder, Skipper." Jones leaned back and lit a cigarette. "He's heading our way. I make him 350, maybe more like 353. Still real faint. But that's our boy. We got him." Jones decided to risk an impertinence. He'd earned a little tolerance. "We wait or we chase, sir?" "We wait. No sense spooking him. We let him come in nice and close while we do our famous imitation of a hole in the water. Then we tag along behind him to wax his tail for a while. I want another tape of this setup, and I want the BC-10 to run a SAP scan. Use the instruction to bypass the processing algorithms. I want this contact analyzed, not interpreted. Run it every 2 minutes. I want his signature recorded, digitalized, folded, spindled, and mutilated. I want to know everything there is about him. His propulsion noises, his plant signature, the works. I want to know exactly who he is." "He's a Ruski, sir," Jones observed. "But which Ruski?" Mancuso smiled. "Aye, Captain." Jones understood. He'd be on duty another 2 hours, but the end was in sight. Almost. Mancuso sat down and lifted a spare set of headphones, stealing one of Jones's cigarettes. He'd been trying to break the habit for a month. He'd have a better chance on the beach. HMS Invincible. Ryan was now wearing a Royal Navy uniform. This was temporary. Another mark of how fast this job had been laid on was that he had only the one uniform and 2 shirts. All of his wardrobe was now being cleaned, and in the interim, he had on a pair of English-made trousers and a sweater. Typical, he thought. Nobody even knows I'm here. They had forgotten him. No messages from the president, not that he'd ever expected one, and Painter and Davenport were only too glad to forget that he was ever on the Kennedy. Greer and the judge were probably going over some damn fool thing or another, maybe chuckling to themselves about Jack Ryan having a pleasure cruise at government expense. It was not a pleasure cruise. Jack had rediscovered his vulnerability to seasickness. The Invincible was off Massachusetts, waiting for the Russian surface force and hunting vigorously after the red subs in the area. They were steaming in circles on an ocean that would not settle down. Everyone was busy, except him. The pilots were up twice a day or more, exercising with their U.S. Air Force and Navy counterparts, working from shore bases. The ships were practicing surface warfare tactics. As Admiral White had said at breakfast, it had developed into a jolly good extension of Nifty Dolphin. Ryan didn't like being a supernumerary. Everyone was polite, of course. Indeed, the hospitality was nearly overpowering. He had access to the command center, and when he watched to see how the Brits hunted subs down, everything was explained to him in sufficient detail that he actually understood about half of it. At the moment, he was reading alone in White's sea cabin, which had become his permanent home aboard. Ritter had thoughtfully tucked a CIA staff study into his duffel bag, entitled Lost Children, a psychological profile of East Bloc defectors. The 300-page document had been drafted by a committee of psychologists and psychiatrists who worked with the CIA and other intelligence agencies, helping defectors settle into American life. And, he was sure, helping spot security risks in the CIA. Not that there were many of those, but there were two sides to everything the company did. Ryan admitted to himself that this was pretty interesting stuff. He had never really thought about what makes a defector, figuring that there were enough things happening on the other side of the Iron Curtain to make any rational person want to take whatever chance he got to run west. But it was not that simple, he read, not that simple at all. Everyone who came over was a fairly unique individual. While one might recognize the inequities of life under communism and yearn for justice, religious freedom, a chance to develop as an individual, another might simply want to get rich, having read about how greedy capitalists exploit the masses and decided that being an exploiter has its good points. Ryan found this interesting, if cynical. Another defector type was the fake, the imposter, someone planted on the CIA as a living piece of disinformation. But this kind of character could cut both ways. He might ultimately turn out to be a genuine defector. America, Ryan smiled, could be pretty seductive to someone used to the gray life in the Soviet Union. Most of the plants, however, were dangerous enemies. For this reason, a defector was never trusted. Never. A man who had changed countries once could do it again. Even the idealists had doubts, great pangs of conscience at having deserted their motherland. In a footnote, a doctor commented that the most wounding punishment for Alexander Solzhenitsyn was exile. As a patriot, being alive far from his home was more of a torment than living in a gulag. Ryan found that curious, but enough so to be true. The rest of the document addressed the problem of getting them settled. Not a few Soviet defectors had committed suicide after a few years. Some had simply been unable to cope with freedom, the way that long-term prison inmates often fail to function without highly structured control over their lives and commit new crimes hoping to return to their safe environment. Over the years, the CIA had developed a protocol for dealing with this problem, and a graph in an appendix showed that the severe maladjustment cases were trending dramatically down. Ryan took his time reading. While getting his doctorate in history at Georgetown University, he had used a little free time to audit some psychology classes. He had come away with the gut suspicion that shrinks didn't really know much of anything, that they got together and agreed on random ideas they would all use. He shook his head. His wife occasionally said that, too. A clinical instructor in ophthalmic surgery on an exchange program at Guy's Hospital in London, Carolyn Ryan regarded everything as cut and dried. If someone had eye trouble, she would either fix it or not fix it. A mind was different, Jack decided, after reading through the document a second time, and each defector had to be treated as an individual, handled carefully by a sympathetic case officer who had both the time and inclination to look after him properly. He wondered if he'd be good at it. Admiral White walked in.
Bored, Jack?
Not exactly, Admiral. When do we make contact with the Soviets?
Well, this evening. Your chaps had given them a very rough time over that Tomcat incident.
Good. Maybe people will wake up before something really bad happens.
You think it will? White sat down.
Well, Admiral, if they really are hunting a missing sub, yes. If not, then they're here for another purpose entirely, and I've guessed wrong. Worse than that, I'll have to live with that misjudgment. Or die with it.
Norfolk Naval Medical Center. Tate was feeling better. Dr. Jameson had taken over for several hours, allowing him to curl up on a couch in the doctor's lounge for 5 hours. That was the most sleep he ever seemed to get in one shot, but it was sufficient to make him look indecently chipper to the rest of the floor staff. He made a quick phone call, and some milk was sent up. As a Mormon, Tate avoided everything with caffeine, coffee, tea, even cola drinks. And though this type of self-discipline was unusual for a physician, to say nothing of a uniformed officer, he scarcely thought about it except on rare occasions when he pointed out its longevity benefits to his brother practitioners. Tate drank his milk and shaved in the restroom, emerging ready to face another day.
Any word on the radiation exposure, Jamie?
The radiology lab had struck out.
They brought a nucleonics officer over from a subtender, and he scanned the clothes. There was a possible 20-rad contamination, not enough for frank physiological effects. I think what it might have been was that the nurse took the sample from the back of his hand. The extremities might still have been suffering from the vascular shutdown. That could explain the depleted white count. Maybe.
How is he otherwise?
Better. Not much, but better. I think maybe the Keflin's taking hold. The doctor flipped open the chart. White count is coming back. I put a unit of white blood into him 2 hours ago. The blood chemistry is approaching normal limits. Blood pressure is 100 over 65, heart rate is 94. Temperature 10 minutes ago was 100.8. It's been fluctuating for several hours. His heart looks pretty good. In fact, I think he's going to make it, unless something unexpected crops up. Jameson reminded himself that in extreme hypothermia cases, the unexpected can take a month or more to appear. Tate examined the chart, remembering what he had been like years ago. A bright young doc, just like Jamie, certain that he could cure the world. It was a good feeling. A pity that experience, in his case, 2 years at Da Nang, beat that out of you. Jamie was right, though. There was enough improvement here to make the patient's chances appear measurably better. "What are the Russians doing?" Tate asked. "Petchkin has the watch at the moment. When it came his turn, and he changed into scrubs, you know he has that Captain Smirnov holding onto his clothes, like he expects us to steal them or something." Tate explained that Petchkin was a KGB agent. "No kidding. Maybe he has a gun tucked away," Jameson chuckled. "If he does, he'd better watch it. We got 3 Marines up here with us."
"Marines? What for?"
"Forgot to tell you. Some reporter found out we had a Rusky up here, and he tried to bluff his way onto the floor. A nurse stopped him. Admiral Blackburn found out and went ape. The whole floor sealed off. What's the big secret, anyway?"
"Beats me, but that's the way it is.
What do you think of this Petchkin guy?"
"I don't know. I never met any Russians before. They don't smile a whole lot. The way they're taking turns watching the patient, you'd think they'd expect us to make off with him."
"Or maybe that he'll say something they don't want us to hear," Tate wondered. "Did you get the feeling that they might not want him to make it? I mean, when they didn't want to tell us about what his sub was." Jameson thought about that.
"No. The Russians are supposed to make a secret of everything, aren't they? Anyway, Smirnov did come through with it."
"Get some sleep, Jamie."
"Aye, Captain."
Jameson walked off towards the lounge. We asked them what kind of sub, the captain thought. Meaning whether it was a nuke or not. What if they thought if we were asking if it was a missile sub? That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A missile sub right off our coast, and all this activity in the North Atlantic? Christmas season. Dear God, if they were going to do it, they'd do it right now, wouldn't they? He walked down the hall. A nurse came out of the room with a blood sample to be taken down to the lab. This was being done hourly, and it left Petchkin alone with the patient for a few minutes. Tate walked around the corner and saw Petchkin through the window, sitting in a chair at the corner of the bed and watching his countryman, who was still unconscious. He had on green scrubs, made to be put on in a hurry. These were reversible, with a pocket on both sides so a surgeon didn't have to waste a second to see if they were inside out. As Tate watched, Petchkin reached for something through the low collar. Oh, God! Tate raced around the corner and shot through the swinging door. Petchkin's look of surprise changed to amazement as the doctor batted a cigarette and a lighter from his hand, then to outrage as he was lifted from his chair and flung towards the door. Tate was the smaller of the two, but his sudden burst of energy was sufficient to eject the man from the room.
"Security!" Tate screamed.
"What is the meaning of this?" Petchkin demanded. Tate was holding him in a bear hug. Immediately, he heard feet racing down the hall from the lobby.
"What is it, sir?" A breathless Marine Lance Corporal with a .45 Colt in his right hand skidded to a halt on the tile floor.
"This man just tried to kill my patient."
"What?"
Petchkin's face was crimson.
"Corporal, your post is now at that door. If this man tries to get into that room, you will stop him any way you have to. Understood?"
"Aye, aye, sir."
The corporal looked at the Russian.
"Sir, would you please step away from the door?"
"What is the meaning of this outrage?"
"Sir, will you step away from the door right now?" The Marine holstered his pistol.
"What is going on here?" It was Ivanov, who had sense enough to ask this question in a quiet voice from 10 feet away.
"Doctor,
Do you want your sailor to survive or not? Tate asked, trying to calm himself.
What? Of course we wish him to survive. How can you ask this?
Then why did Comrade Petchkin just try to kill him?
I did not do such a thing, Petchkin shouted.
What did he do exactly? Ivanov asked. Before Tate could answer, Petchkin spoke rapidly in Russian, then switched to English.
I was reaching for the smoke, that is all. I have no weapon. I wish to kill no one. I only wish to have a cigarette.
We have no smoking signs all over the floor, except in the lobby. You didn't see them? You were in a room in intensive care with a patient on 100% oxygen. The air and bedclothes saturated with oxygen, and you were going to flick your goddamn bick?
The doctor rarely used profanity.
Oh, sure, you'd get burned some, and it would look like an accident, and that kid would be dead.
I know what you are, Petchkin, and I don't think you're that stupid. Get off my floor!
The nurse, who had been watching this, went into the patient's room. She came back out with a pack of cigarettes, two loose ones, a plastic butane lighter, and a curious look on her face. Petchkin was ashen.
Dr. Tate, I assure you that I had no such intention. What are you saying would happen?
Comrade Petchkin, Ivanov said slowly in English. There would be an explosion and fire. You cannot have a flame near oxygen.
Ничего!
Petchkin finally realized what he had done. He had waited for the nurse to leave. Medical people never let you smoke when you ask. He didn't know the first thing about hospitals, and as a KGB agent, he was accustomed to doing whatever he wanted. He started speaking to Ivanov in Russian. The Soviet doctor looked like a parent listening to a child's explanation for a broken glass. His response was spirited. For his part, Tate began to wonder if he hadn't overreacted. Anyone who smoked was an idiot to begin with.
Dr. Tate, Petchkin said finally, I swear to you that I had no idea of this oxygen business. Perhaps I am a fool.
Nurse, Tate turned, we will not leave this patient unattended by our personnel at any time. Never. Have an orderly come to pick up the blood samples and anything else. If you have to go to the head, get relief first.
Yes, doctor.
No more screwing around, Mr. Petchkin. Break the rules again, sir, and you're off the floor for good. Do you understand?
It will be as you say, doctor, and allow me, please, to apologize.
You stay put, Tate said to the Marine. He walked away, shaking his head angrily, mad at the Russians, embarrassed with himself, wishing he were back at Bethesda where he belonged, and wishing he knew how to swear coherently. He took the service elevator down to the first floor and spent 5 minutes looking for the intelligence officer who had flown down with him. Ultimately, he found him in a game room, playing Pac-Man. They conferred in the hospital administrator's vacant office.
You really thought he was trying to kill the guy? The commander asked incredulously.
What was I supposed to think? Tate demanded. What do you think?
I think he just screwed up.
They want that kid alive. No, first they want him talking, more than you do.
How do you know that?
Petchkin calls their embassy every hour. We have the phones tapped, of course.
How do you think?
What if it's a trick?
If he's that good an actor, he belongs in the movies.
You keep that kid alive, doctor, and leave the rest to us.
Good idea to have the Marine close, though. That'll rattle them a bit. Never pass up a chance to rattle them.
So, when will he be conscious?
No telling. He's still feverish and very weak.
Why do they want him to talk? Tate asked.
To find out what sub he was on. Petchkin's KGB contact blurted that out on the phone. Sloppy. Very sloppy. They must be real excited about this.
Do we know what sub it was?
Sure, the intelligence officer said mischievously.
Then what's going on, for Lord's sake?
Can't say, Doc. The commander smiled as if he knew, though he was as much in the dark as anyone.
Norfolk Naval Shipyard. The USS Scamp sat at the dock while a large overhead crane settled the Avalon on its support rack. The captain watched impatiently from atop the sail. He and his boat had been called in from hunting a pair of victors, and he did not like it one bit. The attack boat skipper had only run a DSRV exercise a few weeks before, and right now he had better things to do than play mother whale to this damned useless toy. Besides, having this mini-sub perched on his after-escape trunk would knock 10 knots off his top speed, and there'd be 4 more men to bunk and feed. The scamp was not